Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, if your religious beliefs include the use of illegal psychedelic drugs to achieve enlightenment, does the First Amendment exempt you from the drug laws? Does your religious freedom trump the drug laws? No, said the Supreme Court back in 1990. In a minute, we'll talk about what that ruling has to do with contraception coverage and the Affordable Care Act with Emily Bazelon from Slate. And she'll explain how the Supreme Court gave Amazon equal citizenship with brick-and-mortar stores yesterday. Maybe not the equality it was looking for. It will have to charge sales tax like a store you walk into. Also today, a report from DNA Info that the engineer driving the Metro North train that derailed may have simply dozed off. We'll start a two-part series on New York City media, coming and going. Today, Jim Vanderhei, top dog at Politico and its new local affiliate, Capital New York, which officially relaunches as part of Politico today. Then tomorrow, Adam Moss, editor of New York Magazine, which has announced it is reducing its print edition to every other week, even as it becomes an online powerhouse. And we'll take your calls later on the idea in David Brooks' column today that asks, how much emotional and psychic space should politics take up in a normal, healthy brain? That's all coming up, starting with religious freedom for corporations or individuals and the Supreme Court tacitly blessing sales tax for your online purchases. Emily Bazelon from Slate and the Yale Law School and author of Sticks and Stones, her book about bullying, will help us with this. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Good. I want to get right to the peyote precedent. I want to bring psychedelic drugs into the conversation as quickly as we can. Remind us of this peyote precedent.
Yeah, sure. It's a case called Employment Division versus Smith. And the question in this case was whether a group of Native Americans could use peyote in their religious rituals. And the court said no. It was a 5-4 decision. It was written by Justice Scalia. And on constitutional grounds, it resisted the idea of carving out an exemption from an exemption based on religious freedom to the drug laws, to laws that apply to everybody.
Scalia was on the court then. Justice Kennedy, I think, was on the court then.
Exactly. They're the only two justices on the court now who were part of that decision, and they both voted against the Native American effort to use peyote.
And why does that relate to the Affordable Care Act case that they agreed last week that they will hear?
You are asking all the good questions. After this decision came down from the Supreme Court in 1990, Congress, led by Democrats, passed a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993. And the idea was to make it easier for people, the law used the word persons, to get exemptions from generally applicable laws on the basis of a claim of exercising their freedom of religion. And so that law, which is called RFRA for short, but basically this federal law protecting religious freedom, that's the law the companies claim shows that they don't need to provide contraception for their employees as provided for in the Affordable Care Act.
I'm curious, as a matter of history, if you know, what that Congress had in mind in the 90s when they passed RFRA, when they made it easier for people to claim exemptions based on religious beliefs from federal law, because I have a feeling they weren't protecting the peyote users.
Well, actually, they were concerned about religious minorities. I mean, there was this sense that this Supreme Court decision was going to make it harder for people who are religious dissidents to do the things they need to do to practice their rituals. So you're right. It wasn't that that Congress was super excited about letting people use drugs in religious rituals. But they were concerned that there would be this kind of effort by the state to crack down on religious principles that they thought were basically like odd and out of sync with majority views.
So on this Affordable Care Act contraception coverage case, peyote is one precedent. Another is Citizens United, and you don't usually hear peyote and Citizens United in the same breath, but in this case you do, which many people believe the court must have been on peyote to decide as it did, but that's another story. Giving corporations the same First Amendment free speech rights as individual human beings during political campaigns. How does that come into play with respect to Obamacare contraception coverage?
Well, Citizens United found that corporations can give unlimited donations to what are called independent political expenditure groups, basically PACs and super PACs. And the idea was that, okay, the First Amendment gives rights, again, to persons to free speech, and that corporations have personhood for the purposes of this First Amendment right. So then the lower courts that are looking at these claims now from corporations that they don't have to abide by the contraceptive mandate, they're asking, okay, are these corporations persons as defined by the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the law that Congress passed to protect people's religious freedom? And that sounds like kind of a crazy idea taken on its face, in the same way that we spend a lot of time mocking the idea that corporations are people in Citizens United. But it's not obvious why the court would call a corporation a person for campaign finance cases, but not for exercising religious freedom.
Both are in the First Amendment. The free speech rights and the religious freedoms are both in the First Amendment, which is such an incredibly expansive clause.
Exactly. And to play this argument out a little bit, I don't necessarily agree with it, but to give it to you, one of the courts that found that the corporations don't have to necessarily give contraception to their employees through insurance said, well, you know, in the Citizens United case, the court was balancing the problem of corruption. With religious freedom, there is no corruption problem. There isn't really a countervailing interest, this court claimed. I think you could argue, actually, that this is giving corporations a kind of tyrannical power over the religious rights of their employees. But you can kind of argue it both ways, based simply on what the Supreme Court said in Citizens United.
Right. And I see it also as a conflict between employers and employees, and the question of who the First Amendment actually protects. So if federal law is that all health insurance plans must include contraception coverage for women as a matter of public health law, it seems to me that it protects each woman's religious liberty not to be denied that coverage on the basis of her employer's religious beliefs. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And I think one thing that's important here is, okay, who gets to decide whether there is a compelling interest for women in getting this access to contraception? Does Congress get to decide because Congress passed Obamacare and did put in this requirement? Or does the Supreme Court get to come in and supersede Congress's judgment? And then if the Supreme Court is deciding, well, what's the limiting principle? Where does this end? I mean, these employers are objecting to giving their employees particular kinds of birth control, the morning after pill and IUDs, which they say can basically cause an abortion. That's very scientifically disputed, but that's their claim. What if you had another employer who, for example, was Christian Scientist and felt that their company shouldn't have to pay for health care at all because Christian Scientists question a lot of traditional medicine? That's one of the problems here.
Listeners, it is not every day that you get a Supreme Court case featuring sex, psychedelic drugs, religion, Citizens United, and Obamacare all under the same docket number. But that's what we have here in the case that they agreed last week that they will hear. So call in and weigh in on this, or if you want clarification on any of it, Emily Bazelon is covering this for Slate, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I would love to hear from some business owners or people who feel that you are part of the ownership of a corporation, whether because you own stock in a corporation or maybe you just own your own small business and you feel that your corporation should have the rights of personhood or shouldn't have the rights of personhood, either way. But I would love to get some small business people into this conversation as well as anyone else. 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Emily, it's funny. On our show last Wednesday, we did this kind of loving Valentine to small business owners in our listening area who especially own retail stores where they sell things that might be holiday gifts, right, in conjunction with Small Business Saturday that they have the day after Black Friday, so that people don't only shop in the big box stores but also go to local merchants. And so our callers were some of the small business people. Others were expressing all this love for the institution of small business. Now, the shoe is kind of on the other foot. It's like, what do you mean your business is a person?
Right. And, you know, I've been noticing in trying to write and think about these cases that the pronoun their, T-H-E-I-R, is a problem because we keep talking about their religious liberty, and it becomes as if the owner's religious liberty is also the corporation's religious liberty, even though for almost every purpose of law, we think of a corporation as a separate legal entity, and we don't impute the owner's motives or beliefs to what the corporation is legally required to
That's
do.
It's so interesting that you brought up the pronoun because I'm very aware that when I write copy for the show, I never refer to a company as a who, always as an it.
Right, which
so,
is correct, obviously.
Dow
right?
Chemical, from today's Wall Street Journal. Dow Chemical is a company that might change its name. That's my language, not the journal's, but that's where I saw the story. Dow Chemical is a company that might change its name, not a company who might change their name, things like that.
Exactly. But when you talk about corporations in the plural, there isn't a plural, right, that doesn't – we don't have the equivalent in English unless I'm just not thinking of the grammar
right,
correctly.
Right.
And that, I think, is where the problem creeps in, and we kind of slide from thinking about a corporation. Can a corporation even have a religious belief? Well, no. As you said, the corporation isn't it, but the owners do. And that, I think, is the elision it's important to avoid here.
Right. So let's play with the idea of corporate personhood a little bit, since you and I are both skeptical of it. A corporation is an entity set up by human beings. It's not a rock or a bicycle or a song. It's a business set up by one or more people for the purposes of making money, right? So it's a human endeavor that exists in society to foster the interests of the people doing it. So by that reckoning, why shouldn't the people who own the company be protected in their endeavors like those same people are protected for whatever else they do under the Constitution?
Answer to that is when you form a corporation, you are shielded from personal liability, right? The whole idea is if the corporation runs into financial trouble, you won't be on the hook personally for its debts in the same way. And so we've created this legal creature that has its own reality, its own kind of life. And so at that point, if you're taking advantage of the protections of the corporate structure, why can you then also claim that it somehow is you and directly represents your beliefs?
Aha, that reminds me of the protest sign that I saw on TV at an Occupy rally. I've mentioned this on the air before. It said, "I'll believe a corporation is a person when Texas executes one."
Right. And there was, as my kids love the story about the guy who was pulled over for driving by himself in the HOV lane in the Bay Area. And he said, "Wait a minute, on the front seat next to me are my papers for incorporating my company. And my company is a person. So there are actually two people in this car."
Right. Okay. The HOV lane with your corporate charter. Leslie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Yes, I think she's absolutely right. And I would like to say that Congress has many better things to do than be mucking around in our bodies. Women should be able to decide for themselves.
They want
an abortion or they don't want an abortion.
But in a way, Leslie, your take is a little bit contradictory in an interesting way, because what Congress did is to guarantee by passing a law that all women with health insurance in the age of Obamacare going forward, that all women would have contraception coverage included in their health insurance policies. So this was an act of Congress to say what companies, in effect, and insurance companies must do with respect to women's bodies. You said mucking around with women's bodies. With respect to women having the option to protect their own health.
Right. I'm glad they did that. I think the only reason they did that was because so many companies and perhaps one would say right-wing people or Republicans perhaps or people who are against abortion were trying to limit contraception. Therefore, they wanted to make it a law to guarantee that you have the right to contraception. That's the way I understand it. So you're right. In that point, they did muck around to help our bodies,
yes,
to help us do what we wanted to do.
Leslie, thank you very much. And I wonder if they even had religious owners, Emily, in mind, as Leslie suggests, by including the guarantee for contraception coverage, as opposed to just having cheap policies in mind that might not cover it and, you know, that might tempt people to save money as employers by covering their workers in a lower way that might not include this, which is considered by public health officials as essential primary care.
Right. I mean, also remember, it was pretty clear early on that churches were going to object to this contraception mandate. We had a whole ruckus over that. And the Obama administration essentially made a halfway compromise. They said that churches and explicitly religious organizations would not be subject to the contraception mandate. What is left, what we're talking about in these Supreme Court cases, are secular for-profit corporations.
In fact, it's not just churches, but any nonprofits that want to be exempt can be exempt. So if WNYC is a not-for-profit institution, for whatever reason, decided that it didn't want to include contraception coverage in, you know, the company health policy, it could do that, but ExxonMobil couldn't?
Well, I think there's some actually requirements for nonprofits, because there's another case going on right now where Notre Dame University is challenging the contraception mandate.
But so that's a religious-based institution, too.
Yes. It is, but and it's saying we want to be included in this exemption for churches. So I don't think that it's every single nonprofit that that just makes this claim. But the point is, I think that these Supreme Court cases are about these secular for-profit companies.
Waseem and Parsippany, you're on WNYC. Hello, Waseem.
Hi. Yeah, this is a great discussion, and I think you have brought all the aspects very well together. But I think that what is the most critical point that is being missed is that our Constitution is based on separation of powers of state and the church. But what we have seen in last at least 15, 20 years is that that dam has broken, and it's flooding our political discourse, and we even had somebody like Bush, who by all evidence was a religious extremist, elected and by a party that allowed itself to be taken over by religious extremists and continues to this day.
So the walls are breaking down too much for you. Then again, Waseem, thank you for your call. Emily, this is a different discussion, I guess, but on the one hand, there are many, many people like Waseem who see the walls between church and state breaking down over time. Then you get Sarah Palin's new book, which revives the war on Christmas argument.
Right, yes. And I saw that a conservative group was calling for a boycott of Radio Shack this week because
they were
apparently like taking Christmas out of their holiday greetings or some such. Yeah, I mean, now we're talking about the Establishment Clause and the idea, the question of how much the government can get behind a particular religion or just establish the idea of religion at all in the public square.
Oh, and there's a mayor in the news. Was it somewhere in your state of Connecticut there who agreed to start calling the Christmas tree in front of City Hall a Christmas tree because he and his predecessors used to call it a holiday tree? But then people got so upset that they were taking the Christmas out of Christmas.
Yeah, I think this is a real challenge both for mainstream corporations and also for government officials. There's a way in which, you know, neutering the language of Christmas, I can see how that would bother people and make them feel like the spirit of the holiday was being kind of washed away.
Then again, the government is not supposed to establish Christmas as something that it officially recognizes because Christmas is a particular majority holiday.
Exactly. And, you know, this is tricky. We are a majority Christian country. There are a lot of ways in which, without really even thinking about it, we have institutionalized Christmas. And yet we have this very strict idea about religion in the public square in some context. So I think people find it confusing.
We were doing some New York City political history on the show the other day, and one of the things that came up was Mayor John Lindsay in 1968, I think, lighting a huge menorah outside City Hall to kind of go with the Christmas tree and
right.
make it proportional. Of course, he was going for the huge Jewish vote in New York City at that time. But there you go. Politics following the religious beliefs of the constituents.
Right.
And to drill down on this idea a little further, Linda Greenhouse, former New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, as you know, wrote a column saying this case is really less about who's religious rights and less about Obamacare than it is about the culture war and what kind of sex society should find acceptable. That universal contraception coverage enshrines in law sex out of wedlock as a protected, therefore moral act. And that's what the company, Hobby Lobby, and its allies are trying to prevent. You think she's on to something or reading too much into it?
No, I think that's absolutely a salient argument. And one of the fears that feminists have about the Hobby Lobby cases is that the Supreme Court is going to find some way to basically treat sex and contraception differently from every other kind of health care. That's already happened over and over again in the Supreme Court's abortion cases. And so you just fear that, you know, it's not going to be that any employer with religious owners can deny any kind of health care coverage. There will somehow be this different category of sex-related coverage that will be treated worse than other kinds of health care.
My guest is Emily Bazelon, who covers the Supreme Court and other legal issues for Slate. You hear her on WNYC as part of the Slate Political Gab Fest that we air on the weekends. She's the Truman Capote Fellow, that's a fancy title, at the Yale Law School, and author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. As we talk about this case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear, Obamacare-related, whether companies based on religious rights can opt out of contraception coverage for their employees, which would otherwise be universal under Obamacare. We're going to move on in a minute to the topic of the case that the Supreme Court refused to take yesterday, which will require, since they refused, Amazon and I guess other online retailers to charge sales tax if localities want them to do that. But I just want to linger, Emily, for a couple of more minutes on the Obamacare case, because people are unfortunately no business owners are calling in that I can see, because I would love to get. In fact, maybe we should clear the board of a few calls. Leave me line 5 and line 6. I'm going to take those right now, but clear some other lines. And if anybody listening right now does own a business, call up and tell us if you think your business should have rights under the Constitution as a person in the same way that you do as an individual who owns that business. Does that make sense? 212-433-WNYC. If we can clear some lines for business owners only, and let's hear how some of you relate to this idea if you are actual business owners. But we have so many analogies coming in from people who want to say why businesses are not the same as individuals. Let's just take a few more of those to hear what people are thinking. Andy in Bed-Stuy. Hi, Andy.
Hi there. I don't know whether you all would have sort of an answer, whether this is what's to start a discussion, but I was just curious about where the rights of the corporation would end if they're considered an individual, and you get into stuff like could a corporation like adopt a child, which of course seems sort of surreal and strange, but
right. Okay, so there's one. Could a corporation adopt a child? Angela in Bridgewater, you have another one, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a religious context that believes there's a separation between the body and the soul, and so when a child is born, it's important to baptize the child to ensure eternal life. But we don't baptize or christen a fetus or the result of a miscarriage. So that seems to me to put the child and issues of abortion in a secular context, not a religious context.
Angela, thank you. So, Emily Bazelon, from a legal standpoint, would these arguments ever come up in court? Like, well, could a corporation adopt a child if it's a person? Or could a corporation be baptized if it doesn't have a soul? Is that a person? You know, would people ever make that argument in front of the Supreme Court justices?
I mean, if they sound fanciful. However, if the court starts expanding the concept of corporations having personhood, you could imagine this very bizarre slippery slope where corporations start laying claim to this idea in lots of other contexts. I don't know why a company would want to adopt a baby or be baptized, but, you know, maybe there's someone out there who has a reason to ask for that.
And isn't that one of the reasons this would get theological and obscure in a hurry, but maybe you know, because I know you've written a lot about abortion rights. Isn't one of the reasons that Catholics object to abortion that there already is a fetus with a soul, and the fetus, that person, would wind up in some kind of religious limbo forever and ever in the afterlife?
Yeah, I think you're right that the idea of purgatory extends to fetuses. I really hope I'm not messing up Catholic doctrine there.
So you can't make the same argument quite with respect to your light bulb store.
Right. I mean, this is where I think this idea just strikes many of us as nonsensical. And then the question is, well, why do we have it at all? And when Congress said persons for purposes of protecting religious freedom, why would courts read companies into that word?
Right. Larry in Long Island City, you own a business. Thank you for calling in.
Yes. My perspective is that a business is a separate entity, as she was just discussing, and the country was founded on an individual basis, and that's where the rights belong, not with a corporation.
You want to plug your business? I'll let you do that.
I'm in metals trading, all different scrap metals and things like that. And business is good, could be better, but this whole Supreme Court allowing corporations to have such power, it just boggles my mind. Growing up in this area and going to school as a kid in the 60s, that individuals and freedoms of individuals was the foundation of the country and not the corporation, even though the corporation has grown and has so much tremendous power these days.
So what couldn't your own corporation do, in your opinion, that you should be allowed to do as the owner?
Well, I think that we have plenty of freedoms and plenty of rights, and I don't need my corporation to have the right to express my personal religious views on my employees. I think that would be a horrible way to go.
Larry, just one more question by way of a stretch for a segue. Can people buy scrap metal online, or do they have to come into your store? I don't mean from you or from anybody. Can people buy scrap metal? Do you have competition now? I assume you have a storefront, if that's the right term.
Actually, no. We deal more with the with manufacturers, and storefronts would come to us.
Uh-huh, right.
But we do have an online site, yes.
And you have an online site. So do you think that people who buy from you online should be exempt from sales tax? Ha-ha.
Ah, that's a good question. If it's for personal use, I would say no. If they are using it to manufacture or make something with it, then they should be exempt, yes.
Interesting. Okay, Larry, thank you very much. Well, that was a stretch, Emily, right, to segue to the Amazon case?
I don't know. I thought he went for it. You got away with it.
He went for it in an interesting way, which is that he thinks it depends on the intent of the customer. If somebody's buying something for personal use, then they shouldn't have to pay sales tax when they buy it online. But if they're buying it to manufacture into another product to sell, then they should. I don't think that's where anybody's arguing.
No, the basic legal test from the Supreme Court is much more boring. The Supreme Court just asks whether the internet retailer has a, quote, substantial nexus in the state where the customer that the state wants to tax lives.
So this Amazon case that the Supreme Court refused to hear yesterday, arguing in a sense the opposite of the corporate position in the contraceptive case. I don't know if anybody else has made this point, but that a corporation is exempt from the responsibilities of human beings under the Constitution because, unlike a person, a store can locate itself in cyberspace, which is really nowhere, and therefore is not responsible for paying local sales taxes to any place at all. Is that their argument?
Well, their argument is also that they're different from what we all call bricks and mortar stores, right? That those stores are actually located physically in a place. It's fine for the states to charge them a sales tax. But if you're doing your business out in the ether, then you shouldn't be subject to the same tax. I mean, look, this is obviously an incredibly self-serving argument if you are a company like Amazon and you're trying to keep your price point lower.
Isn't that also how our friends at Apple managed to avoid billions in corporate taxes? They set themselves up in some international legal netherworld that was not in any country's jurisdiction for tax purposes, something a person could not physically do?
Yes, They went beyond sales tax avoidance. I'm sorry, they went beyond state sales tax avoidance into trying to avoid all kinds of federal taxes as well.
So corporations have more rights than people under the law because they have the rights but not the responsibilities.
Well, this is the problem, I think, with thinking of them as persons, is that it becomes this very elastic concept where the corporations are companies with more limited rights and responsibilities whenever that suits their owners. And then how can they then turn around and claim otherwise when they all of a sudden want to exercise some other right?
And this was a New York case. So when the Supreme Court refused yesterday to hear the appeal, that means that New York can charge sales tax on your Amazon purchases if your delivery address is in New York, correct?
Exactly. And the idea here, the reason the state attorney general didn't want the court to get involved was saying that New York wants to treat online and in-state retailers equally. And that's obviously a way of protecting the bricks and mortar stores from having higher prices because you don't have to pay sales tax only if you buy stuff online.
And they'll get plenty of tax deductions anyway at Amazon since they're developing those delivery drones, which will take a lot of R&D. And I think we're going to talk about the delivery drone proposal on tomorrow's show. But Emily Bazelon, Legal Eagle for Slate and author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Excellent as usual. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we're going to hear a report from Murray Weiss of DNA Info that the driver of that derailed Metro North train may have simply fallen asleep, may have simply dozed off. No drugs, no texting. We'll hear what the sourcing is for that and what the implications are of that. Stay with us.